Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host for today. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer and our voice, as you will hear, as needed in today's program. This is my first hosting of the Old Mole in this new year. So just as I did on our last show of 2021, I want to pause a bit to remember where we are in time. I mentioned then that one of my all-time favorite authors is Eduardo Galeano, an Uruguayan writer of anecdotes and parables. One of his last books before he died in 2015 was Los Hijos de los Días, Children of the Days, in which he highlighted a significant event in history specific to each day of the calendar. Here are a couple that intrigue me from this month. For January 2nd, he wrote, "On this day in 1492, Granada fell, and with it fell Muslim Spain. Triumph of the Holy Inquisition. Granada was the last Spanish kingdom where mosques, churches, and synagogues could live side by side in peace. That same year, the conquest of America began, when America was still a mystery without a name. And in the years that followed, in distant bonfires, the same flames would consume the books of Muslims, of Jews, and of America's indigenous peoples. Fire was the only fate for words born in hell." In case that wasn't clear, by words born in hell, he meant those books by Muslims, Jews, and American indigenous peoples condemned for not being Christian. And then for January 3rd, Galeano wrote, "On the third day of the year, 47 BC, the most renowned library of antiquity burned to the ground. After Roman legions invaded Egypt during one of the battles waged by Julius Caesar against the brother of Cleopatra, fire devoured most of the thousands upon thousands of papyrus scrolls in the Library of Alexandria. A pair of millennia later, after American legions invaded Iraq during George W. Bush's crusade against an imaginary enemy, most of the thousands upon thousands of books in the Library of Baghdad were reduced to ashes. Throughout the history of humanity, only one refuge kept books safe from the war and conflagration, the walking library, an idea that occurred to the Grand Vizier of Persia, Abdul Qasim Ismail, at the end of the 10th century. This prudent and tireless traveler kept his library with him, 117,000 books aboard 400 camels formed a caravan a mile long. The camels were also the catalog. They were arranged according to the titles of the books they carried, a flock for each of the 32 letters of the Persian alphabet." I highlight those particular observations. This is Norm Diamond again, back from Galeano. I highlight those, or those anecdotes, because once again we're facing attack on books that challenge the restrictive viewpoints that narrow-minded members of our community would impose. Books, for instance, that acknowledge the existence of alternative sexualities. Books that tell the true story of black struggles and accomplishments during Reconstruction. Books that attempt to encourage our students to think of themselves as being able to make a difference in the world. Once again, we're hearing talk of book burning, even jokes about book burning, from elected school board members in our state. Something else happened in history this month that I'd like to highlight. Yesterday, Sunday, was the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, 1905, in the city called Petrograd. Thousands of people, led by a priest, marched hand in hand in the Russian winter to the palace of the Tsar, their little father, to beg him, in God's name, to make more bread available. Little Father ordered his troops to fire, killing 500, and setting off the 1905 revolution that led not only to the Russian Revolution of 1917, but to our final reading from Galeano, another January curiosity, perhaps more lightheartedly indicting a book. In 1918, in the midst of the revolutionary upheaval in Moscow, Anatoly Lunacharsky presided over the court that judged God. A Bible sat in the chair of the accused. According to the prosecutor, throughout history, God had committed many crimes against humanity. The defense lawyer assigned to the case argued that God was not fit to stand trial due to mental illness, but the tribunal sentenced him to death. At dawn on this day, he's talking about January 17th, 5 rounds of machine gun fire were shot at the heavens. The attack on books relates to a theme on today's program, the importance of premises we bring to our understanding of the world and to our efforts to change it. We'll examine cynicism through the lens of a movie and see it in action as it undercuts activism. We'll look at the official song for the state of Oregon and hear a poem written in response to its blatant biases. In listening to part 2 of an interview on German social democracy and its electoral victory last year, we'll ask where that organization's conception of the world and of possibilities is likely to take it. And we'll look back in Oregon history to find out what happened to someone who took seriously the notion that all people are created equally when his neighbors didn't share that premise. First on the program, Bill Resnick interviews Bill Smaldone. 2 weeks ago, they talked about the long, and I would say troubled, history of the German Social Democratic Party, which has included revolutionary elements and reformist, and even once in power after World War I, repressive. It's this party to which the great Marxist revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg belonged. It's this party that sent right-wing paramilitaries to kill her, also a January event. Back in power after the Nazis were defeated, the SPD promoted some reforms while adapting to the U.S.-run world order in the West. After their surprising victory last year, where will they go from here? To set the mood, here's a bit from the Einheitsfrontlied, the song of the United Front, written in 1934 in response to the Nazis' banning of labor unions.
Weil der Prolet ein Prolet ist, drum wird ihn kein anderer befreien. Es kann die Befreiung der Arbeiter nur das Werk der Arbeiter sein. Drum links, zwei, drei, drum links, zwei, drei, und ein Platz.
No one else will free us. The liberation of the working class is the job of the workers themselves. That's from the song of the United Front. Now, here's Bill Resnick with Bill Smaldone.
Bill Smaldone, welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Great to be back.
Bill Smaldone teaches history at Willamette University, his specialty, Germany in the 20th century, and in particular the struggle for socialism in Germany. Last week, we discussed the history of the left in Germany. The Social Democratic Party started in 1863 when Germany was industrializing, beginning with a quite radical program, seeing labor as the source of all production and wealth, seeing also, in the words of the American Wobblies, the boss's brains that are under the workers' hats, and thus deserving to run the economy and state, and to do it democratically in one great cooperative. No chattel slavery, no wage slavery. Democratic not just in elections, but throughout social life. But over the years, the radicals and reformers in the Social Democratic Party came into serious conflict. The reformers, aided by Germany's elites, defeated the radicals, indeed killed their leaders, but at the same time became a permanent party in Germany's political struggle. Indeed, after World War I and II destituted Germany, the Social Democrats were crucial in German recovery, ultimately forming an industrialized welfare state that came to dominate the European economy. But through the post-war years, the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, they abandoned any sense of socialism or worker liberation and steadily lost power and support. Their vote declined from 40% in 2004 to 15% in 2015, and political experts left them for dead. Well, then came a big surprise. The Social Democratic Party finished first in last year's election, and we'll be discussing how that happened, in particular to what extent it was a product of the crises capitalism has made for us, but crises that our elites refuse to respond to. Right now, Germany, a little less than other nations, are immersed in several deep crises. Why is that? It's because Germany's economic elites, like those around the world, are still plundering and devastating the ecosystems in which human life depends. So, Bill Smalltown, once again in Germany, the SPD is leading a coalition facing a deep set of crises. My chief question is whether the Social Democrats might rise to the occasion to take meaningful steps to deal with the climate crisis. But before then, Bill, why do you think Olaf Scholz and the Social Democrats won the September 21 election?
Well, I think, Bill, that there were a combination of factors. One factor that is rather banal is the fact that the Christian Democrats had been leading the government since 2004 under Angela Merkel's leadership, and people had sort of gotten tired of the Christian Democrats. The other factor from thinking about the right was that the Christian Democrats were bleeding support to the far right. In 2004, when they first came to power, there was no Alternative for Germany, but now the Alternative for Germany party, which is a far-right party, an anti-immigration party, is firmly rooted in the parliament, and the CDU-CSU coalition, these Christian Democratic parties, were bleeding support to the right. That hurt them in the elections, and that was in part due to Angela Merkel's opening of the country to large-scale immigration a few years back. The other reasons were that the leader of the Social Democrats, Olaf Scholz, has been in government with Angela Merkel for a long time. For the last 4 years, they were the junior partner in a grand coalition with the Christian Democrats, and Scholz himself was the finance minister. And he has a long track record in German politics, and he was regarded by many voters as a stable force who would, in some ways, continue Angela Merkel's policy, and that is really a policy of stability, someone who's not particularly radical. One other very important reason that the Social Democrats were carried to power is that their coalition allies, the Greens, did extremely well. And the Greens were willing to form a coalition with the SPD. And that's, of course, key, right? They have to be willing to work together. So the Reds and the Greens were able to put together a pretty good coalition program. Now, where it starts to get complicated is that to get enough votes in the parliament to have a majority, they had to bring one more party in. And the party that they brought in was the Free Democratic Party, which is a classical liberal party. And that party is pretty strong on individual civil rights, but it's also a free market party. And it has often been the swing party in German politics between social democratic governments and Christian democratic governments. Back in the 1970s, there had been a kind of leftward swing in the party, and they were willing to join up with the Social Democrats and govern in a regime that brought about a fairly large expansion of the welfare state. Then in the 1980s, they swung in a neo-Keynesian direction and abandoned the Social Democrats and went over to the right and allied themselves with the Christian Democrats. And now, in 2022, in the context of rising authoritarian movements on the right, very severe immigration problems, and of course, the climate crisis. Everyone in Germany on the left and in the middle, so to speak, is quite aware that these problems have to be grappled with. And so I think the three parties that form the coalition, the SPD, the Greens, and the FDP, were willing to make enough concessions in putting together their government program to work together. And that is very important because the government has to put together a coherent set of policies that it can push through the parliament. But the other thing I want to say is that normally in German politics, the big issues are issues like equality, the issue of whether or not the welfare state should expand. People fight about technology investments and infrastructure investments. There's always a labor component to every election. There are also sometimes people who elevate things like law and order. So those are kind of standard issues that dominate German elections traditionally. This year, however, there were some new issues, or issues that have been around for a while but now clearly broke through to the top. And the key one there was that of climate change. And this was really driven to the fore last summer when there was a catastrophic event in the Rhine Valley during the summer when whole towns and villages were swept away in an instance of massive flooding that took everybody by surprise. It was historically unprecedented. It resulted in many deaths and incredible infrastructure damage. Many people were driven out of their houses. Whole villages and towns were basically wiped out. And this convinced almost everyone on the political spectrum, including the Christian Democrats, that somebody has to do something about the environment. So this was, of course, a great issue for the Greens, right? And they pushed it in the election. And in addition to that, many people are very interested in pursuing issues like digitalization, the modernization of Germany's communications infrastructure. So those two new issues also played a really important role in this election.
My sense is in reading that the housing issue, especially in Berlin, was quite important.
Yes, and the government has called for the construction of something like 400,000 new units per year, I think, a quarter of which will be publicly supported. And so these are traditional, you know, sort of social democratic bread and butter issues. One of the things that Scholz is probably going to do, and he did this to some degree in his campaign rhetoric, is go back to the traditional assertions that social democracy is the party of social justice, right? And this position had been abandoned or watered down is a better way of putting it, by social democratic leaders like Gerhard Schröder, who in 2004 put through a policy called Agenda 2010, which was one of these third-way models. Bill Clinton and Blair pursued very similar models when they were in power in the 90s and early 2000s, which cut the rug out, really, from underneath the feet of working-class people, made it much more difficult to be unemployed, but put a lot more controls over welfare state spending, basically abandoned their working-class constituency in an effort to reach out to middle-class people. And the Social Democrats have paid an enormous price for that as their constituency melted away. Now we've seen a kind of return to those old bread and butter issues, right? And you see it, for example, in the housing policy that I just mentioned. You see it also in the government's assertion that it is going to invest vast sums in public health and is going to also reform the entire welfare state system so that there's a kind of basic income available for everyone. So these are huge changes in direction for the Social Democrats since the Schröder era.
This is KABU Radio, 99.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, here talking to Bill Smaldone. We've been discussing the Social Democratic Party, the surprise victory they won. No one expected it. They formed the coalition government. My sense is that Olaf Scholz starts, as did Joe Biden, facing multiple crises, and then the economic crisis of all Europe, less in Germany, but Germany is key to the European Union that they support, and it's very important for Germany to stabilize the economies of some of the countries that are still in deep trouble. My sense is, and I think we have to speculate about it, that Scholz might pull a Biden on economic and environmental policies and operate like Biden, both professional politicians with very conservative records on almost all things. And particularly, Scholz was very conservative about going into debt and allowing the countries of the South and Europe to run bigger debts to stimulate their economy. He was always seen as, like Biden, being a nice guy, concerned with their welfare, but conservative policies. Biden, though, of course, he went left in his campaign and even more left when he became president. His campaign featured raising the minimum wage, reducing student debt, taxing the rich, a child care tax credit that would put a very large amount of money into the families who are struggling today. Also, he announced and pushed for Build Back Better, a huge program, trillions of dollars on infrastructure and climate change, roads, bridges, but also auto emission standards, closing coal plants, on and on. Millions of jobs for workers displaced and many others of the unemployed. Now it looks like it won't win much. Bill, let's speculate. Might the German Social Democrats also, it looks as if they may be staking their future on creating necessary social programs and also doing an economic reconstruction to stop climate change.
Right. So, first of all, we have to remember that, in a way, Scholz has already made that turn that you describe. If you read the coalition program, if you read what the SPD arguing about it, you will see that their starting point is already far superior in the welfare state to that of the United States. So we're talking about a system that already was spending very large sums, for example, on children. You know, everyone in Germany for decades, all families have received a per-child allowance from the state, okay, to help them raise their children. And now they're basically going to increase those programs, you know, very substantially, and they're going to provide what they're calling a basic security blanket for all children, right, to keep all children out of poverty. And this is going to consist of large-scale investments in family policy. Another thing that they're doing in the American context is, at the moment, unthinkable, even for Biden, is they're going to pile very large sums into care for the aged, which is already a part of the German health insurance system. But this system now is going to be beefed up because the population is aging, and this has become a priority for the state. And they realize that they need to have better workers, better paid workers, raise their skill levels. All of that's going to require lots of investment. And the German state is claiming this now as a priority. In other words, their point of departure is already stronger than that of the United States, and they're going to now elevate the system very substantially.
You know, one thing you didn't mention, they have universal coverage, insurance coverage of every person in every German, is it, Bill, every German resident?
The medical system in Germany is very complicated, but the bottom line is that by law, all people who receive wages and salaries have to be in the German public system, right, or in the German medical system. Everybody has to have insurance. There are different ways to get it, public and private, but it's a mandatory system into which everyone must enroll, unless you are an independent entrepreneur or a government official. The government officials have a different system for themselves. It's very good. And people who are independently wealthy basically buy their insurance on the private markets. But over 90% of the population, by law, must be in the basic system. I wanted to get back, though, to the government's program. And that is one thing I haven't mentioned, is that they are going to now ramp up with major investments in environmental protection. And we're talking here not only in the energy sector, but also in the conservation area. So their intent is to move out of coal as soon as possible, I think by 2030 or 2035. This is a commitment by the government. They want to move toward more wind and water power. And they're also talking about investments in hydrogen. There have been some controversial discussions in the last few weeks about the role of atomic energy in the European framework, and that could be an item of contention. Also, natural gas is an item of contention. The natural gas question, by the way, is also connected to foreign policy because the Germans wish to acquire gas from Russia via an enormous pipeline that is being constructed. And the Germans must have access to gas, either from the Russians or from somebody else, because they have no fossil fuel production at home. So there are some real commitments to major changes. One of the reasons why I'm quite confident that some of these are going to be realized is because the Green Party will not survive if they don't make good on the promises they've made to their constituency. The Green Party has grown very substantially in the last 10 to 15 years. It is a major player. It competes head-to-head with the Social Democrats. Its reputation rests on its ability to carry out environmentally friendly policies. It has made big promises in this campaign, and it cannot afford not to succeed. The difficulty with all of this, and this is going to be where we see whether or not Scholz can truly lead this coalition, is that the Free Democrats, while they're willing to participate in the coalition, they are, at heart, a neoliberal party. That is, a free trader party. They want small government. They recognize that there is a crisis in the environment, and they are willing to make some concessions. But they are not surrendering their core ideological standpoint, which is that the market is always better than the state. And they have the finance ministry. Christian Lindner, who is the leader of the FDP, is the finance minister. And I am certain that there will be heated moments in the cabinet when they are trying to figure out where they're going to get the money to pay for these programs. The other thing that has to be remembered here is that the German government of the 1990s created the European Union political and economic system. And the basis of that was a neoliberal economic framework. And the Germans have dominated financial policy inside the EU for three decades. That has always been a tight money policy with strict controls over individual states' ability to run deficits. Now, they loosened those controls, first in the wake of the 2008 crisis, but then especially in the wake of COVID-19. Scholz has promised that big loans will be taken out, that they will pursue deficit spending to meet the needs of the country in the COVID crisis and in carrying out these policies. He has also said that they will be successful at reining in the costs of the debt as they were after 2008. So in other words, he's on the one hand saying we're going to borrow big, but don't worry, we'll manage it and we'll pay it down. Okay, because every German wants to know whether or not the government can actually pay it down, because Germany has had two experiences in the 20th century with hyperinflation in which the currency was essentially made worthless. And many Germans are convinced, whether rightly or wrongly, that the only way to prevent that from happening is to avoid large-scale debt. So the coalition consists of an interesting arrangement of bedfellows, and the FDP is the most conservative element in that coalition and will certainly be a brake on the government's ability to spend, as will Scholz's own reputation. Now, I want to say something about Scholz's reputation, because you brought it up in your introduction. You described him as a conservative, and it is true that in the Social Democratic Party over the last few decades, he had been a part of the conservative right wing. But it's also true that he began his career as the deputy leader of the Young Socialist Organization and was on the far left of the party at that time. And so, you know, it's a little too early to tell, but Scholz's biographers are always going to wonder if he moves left while in power, if really in his deepest inner self, right, if he really wasn't a kind of closet leftist. We'll see, right? Because certainly I agree with you that he's going to have to adopt policies that are much further to the left than he would have just a few years ago in his role as a finance minister.
No, you were really informative on the possibilities of Germany, who have actually done a great deal in there are some days in Germany that wind and sun power is so great that they're selling electricity to France because they have no use for it in Germany. They are creeping up on a very high level of renewable energy. And Scholz, in fact, talked about his promise to create far, far more onshore wind turbines and solar panels, which creates a turning point. Bill, we should talk about Germany and energy, the great crisis the world faces. It's very important to see an alternative. In fact, Scholz made a speech where he made that point. We have to show an alternative. I think it looks very promising if the combination of the Greens and the SPD, the Social Democrats, reaches the 50% mark where they, in fact, can control the legislative process. It seems to me that Germany could be an example of how the industrialized nations have to operate. Bill Smaldone, thanks so much for talking to us today.
A pleasure, Bill.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone. Now, closer to home, were you aware that Oregon has an official state song? Just as we have a state rodent, state insect, state nut, state governor, state bird, tree, gemstone, we have a state song. It's called Oregon, My Oregon, and it's sung at the beginning of every state legislative session. And until just a few months ago, it was blatantly offensive. I am not going to play it for you. You can find its praise of white male settlers easily enough online. What I am going to play is Harold Johnson's poetic response, Down in the Valley, read and sung by Harold himself. Harold is a local treasure. Nearing 90, he taught English in the Portland Public Schools experimental night school for kids struggling with more conventional schooling. He describes his poetry as an attempt to create art that is culturally relevant and to present his own experience of life in America. And that would have to include, as you will hear, his own experience as a black man. Harold's most recent book of poetry is Article 2, The Gallery. In 2014, he published his first novel, The Fort Showalter Blues. When he titles his poem, Down in the Valley, what valley do you think he's talking about? Could it be the Willamette Valley? Or does he also have a more biblical valley in mind? Here's Harold Johnson.
In the poem, I use the acronym VOTSOD, Chapels, V-O-T-S-O-D, which stands for Valley of the Shadow of Death. Down in the valley, my Oregon, land of the empire builders, we hear now. Try imagining the consciousness, love, out of which that song came. It teaches school children to sing it. Conquered and held by free men, by the time I bust down across the Columbia to strengthen my ABCs, I didn't have to get permission from the white-headed eagle to be in the territory. Didn't have to show up every 6 months to receive 39 lashes if my brown ass was still there. Fairest and the best. But I did have to dodge the red-headed overseer who invited me not to show up for student teaching like I was somebody's university hoop hire, not wired for Chaucer, Coleridge, Keats, prelude to decades of dumb presumption on sidewalks and streets, mountains, waterfalls, fervent evergreens with me down in this shady Vatsad. Yay, with me, Bach, Handel, Thelonious and Miles, fleshed bleating anthems and biting bugs. Cool, but still, we got this blustery tramp, Mondial boogeyman, fronting a tone-deaf chorus, waving his busted niblick. Blessed by the blood of martyrs, Billy, Lady Gaga, Lizzo, Ms. Merkel and ministers of grace, defend us. Oh yeah, I dig the rain.
Thank you, Harold Johnson. The offensive lyrics to Oregon, My Oregon were changed by the legislature just this past June. I'm not going to play you the new version either. If you're interested, we're still the land of heroes and the grandest and the best. I find the self-glorification interferes with real understanding of our history and actually addressing problems in the present. Now, it's time for our regular feature, Another World is Possible. A couple of weeks ago, in their review of the current movie sensation, Don't Look Up, one of our movie moles characterized that film as cynical. I've not seen Don't Look Up, so can't weigh in on that discussion, but was struck by the characterization. Shortly before that, a listener had sent me a poster with a quote from John Sayles about cynicism. He did that both because I mentioned Sayles' movie, Matewan, about coal miners attempting to organize, the last time I hosted the Old Mole, and because he remembered an essay I published years ago on the topic of cynicism. In that essay, written back in that long-ago era when innocent belief in the American way of life, you have to hear that phrase, the American way of life, in capital letters and accompanied by red, white, and blue spangles, in that era when large numbers of people believed, or at least accepted, that all it took to get ahead was hard work, The Democrat and Republican political parties represented all the political possibilities we could ever imagine, that the motives behind U.S. military actions in the rest of the world were altruistic, maybe even that private wealth and abundant consumer goods were the outward sign of heavenly approval. When that interconnected set of beliefs was widespread in this country, I argued that encouraging cynicism would be the next ploy short of outright repression that the ruling elites would draw on to control our unruly population. In other words, that cynicism in print and film would come to function as a sophisticated means of social control. I'll ask Patricia, my studio sidekick, to read you that John Sayles poster in a minute. But first, I'd like us to be clear on what cynicism means politically and how it's different from skepticism. And before that, here's our decidedly uncynical theme music for Another World Is Possible. We have The Guillotine by The Coup. Perhaps the best way to understand cynicism is in contrast with skepticism. Skepticism says, you'll have to show me, otherwise I'm dubious. It is open to engagement and persuasion. Cynicism, on the other hand, is a removed perspective, a renunciation of any responsibility, an attitude rejecting involvement. It can be completely critical of what exists, but dismiss any possibility of change. Many of our listeners will remember another great and hopeful labor film about miners, Salt of the Earth, from the 1950s. Here's what its director had to say about the atmosphere in which the film appeared, the political atmosphere in which the film was boycotted and banned.
Negation was not of the fissures and shortings in our society and culture, only of life and man. McCarthy had been jettisoned, but McCarthyism persisted in the basic assumptions under which we lived. One was free to attack our mores, institutions, personages, without limit or fear, so long as one also despaired and offered no alternative.
It was fine, in other words, to point out all the flaws and horrors of the social economic system we have, as long as you offer no hope of any significant change. Now here's what John Sayles has to say about cynicism. This is taken from a poster honoring the Lincoln Brigade, U.S. radicals of the 1930s, who left home to fight for the democratic government in Spain against the forces of fascism.
One of the major obstacles in the way of human progress, of human understanding, is cynicism. The cynicism that states that people only act in their own self-interest, or what they believe to be their self-interest, that says within every seemingly altruistic act there lurks a dark core of greed or hatred or fear. To make people behave, the cynics say, to make society work, you have to know how to exploit and manipulate that dark core. That's life, the cynics say. That's just the way people are. And you can listen to this for a while and maybe agree up to a point. But then you say, what about the guys in the Lincoln Brigade? Then the cynics will go to work and talk about raw youth and misplaced idealism and what this faction did to that faction. But they won't go away, those guys who shipped out for Spain to fight for other people's freedom. They stand up in history like the one tree on a battlefield not leveled by the bombing. Stand up and make you ask, how did that happen? They won't go away. If you talk to them or read their accounts, What you hear again and again is that they went to Spain because of a belief in what people could be, in how people could live together. And they put their lives on the line for that belief, and a lot of them died. But they lost, say the cynics, not knowing that it is more important that they fought. Fought when they didn't have to fight. Fought when it brought no public glory in their hometowns. Fought to put a lie to the cynicism that keeps people in darkness. They won't go away. And in a world run by cynics, in a time when caring about someone you've never met is seen as weakness or treachery, how much strength have we taken from the thought of them? How much pride and comfort to be able to say, but what about the guys in the Lincoln Brigade?
My essay on cynicism examined in some depth a new movie from the time I wrote the essay, a very clever and creative film called Coonskin by Ralph Bakshi that interspersed animated cartoons with live footage. As the title apparently is intended to indicate, Coonskin is an exposé of the situation of blacks in the United States. As I wrote at the time, however, its perception and criticism of the defects and horrors of our social system are in seeming contradiction to its social quiescence. Cynicism is the reconciliation of that contradiction, turning a potentially radical movie profoundly conservative. Beginning with an attempted prison break in the South, the story is an explicit update of the old Br'er Rabbit tales, with the main character even named Rabbit. The original Br'er Rabbit was a product of slave culture, a subtle expression of resistance to oppressive conditions, in which a weak but clever trickster can outwit stronger foes by seeming to go along with them and by being close enough to know and take advantage of weaknesses hidden behind their dominance. This aspect of slave culture verbalized resistance in a way that helped people hold their heads up, survive, but did not much threaten the real-life structure of oppression and exploitation. In Coonskin, the updated story retains its character of individual resistance joined to social inaction. The movie was picketed at the time for being racist, though I think not for the best of reasons. In fact, I'm sure its creators saw it as an attack on racism. But it's clearly not enough to throw around the word racism, as the characters in the film do, in casual ways that amount to little more than name-calling. The film exaggerates racial stereotypes, both physical features and behavior, clearly in order to mock the stereotypes. But this device is dangerous and risks having the opposite effect, reinforcing the stereotypes. Even worse, black women throughout are portrayed as passive objects, rewards for male activity. More important than any narrow sense in which Coonskin is racist is its acceptance of and encouragement that we accept a society permeated with racism that is employed to keep us all down. It presents Rabbit as someone with whom to identify, glorying a form of resistance to racism and oppression that is only an individual adaptation, inseparable from and more fundamental than any racism in the film, is its cynicism. The film raises an interesting question for the Old Mole and KABU and all non-commercial alternative media in exposing so much of what is wrong with this society while it disguises and rejects the possibility of effective action toward change. Leaving aside for a moment its overt cynicism, let's ask, what is accomplished toward combating societal ills by only exposing them? Does simple muckraking represent progress if it does not also raise the possibility of fundamentally different and better social arrangements? Or if it does not even offer alternative ways to think about social possibilities than the conservative premises of the status quo? Exposé and criticism by themselves leave intact the framework of understanding which shapes how we approach solutions to the problems exposed. And here we're fully back to the problem of cynicism. Cynicism in that framework of understanding, cynicism in our premises. Think back to that John Sayles poster. It is our premises about people's capabilities, about human nature, about social possibilities that underlie our willingness to act or not and determine the kind of action we undertake. Film and art and media more broadly can influence those premises. Here's how I ended that long ago essay.
For art to suggest that a better society is a real possibility does not require the explicit portrayal of that society, nor that the artist be committed to one fully worked out vision of the future. There are other ways to present alternatives. Within this society, there are people tentatively joining together, attempting to be self-conscious actors rather than the objects of forces beyond their control. Sensitive and supportive treatment of the difficulties and limits of such efforts is a challenge worthy of the highest talent. We lack in literature and art very many plausible representations of worthwhile change, of people realizing, becoming aware of and acting on and thus recognizing even more their hitherto doubted capabilities relevant to social change. Exploring this theme could not only be a boost to people's sense of what is possible, but also a contribution to our sense of how to make it happen. Real alternatives are possible, but they will not develop of their own accord. If it is widespread, cynicism becomes self-fulfilling. Overcoming cynicism, at least partly transcending the resignation and the aloofness, is a prerequisite to beginning to eliminate the social conditions which breed political despair. Our efforts have a chance to make a difference.
That's why we're here at the Old Mole, to bring a constant reminder to you and ourselves that another world is possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Did you get the point of that commentary/film review? Billy Bragg did. Here, backed by the Blokes, he sings, "Some Days I See the Point."
Never saw a meaningful TV advert. I don't think shopping is a metaphor for life. Don't waste my time at the gym in the morning. Try to keep trim by living my life. Wanna feel the wind blowing in my head. Wanna hear the waves crashing on the beach. I'm not seeking easy answers or inner peace. I'm just looking for some relief. I want to help to make the world better, but I can't do it all on my own. Try to keep the lead on my disappointment, 'cause cynicism's such a cop-out, I know.
I want to help to make the world better, but I can't do it all on my own. Try to keep the lead on my disappointment, 'cause cynicism's such a cop-out, I know. That was Billy Bragg and the Blokes, Now Matt Witt reviews Oregon Outcast by Jan Wright, a fascinating biography of an Oregonian who back in the 1850s protested the theft of indigenous lands by some of those white settlers glorified till just last year in our official state song. Given how our land of heroes acquired the land, how do you suppose John Beeson's neighbors would have reacted to his advocacy for Native Americans? Matt?
When I moved to the small town of Talent, Oregon, people I would meet would say, "Oh, you live near the house where John Beeson used to live." I started to wonder, who was John Beeson? And if he doesn't live here now, why are people still talking about him? And that's where a recent book called Oregon Outcast by Jan Wright comes in. It's the definitive story of who John Beeson was, a story that not only makes a fascinating read, but that has a lot of relevance in our world today. John Beeson, it turns out, was a white Oregonian who devoted his life to speaking out against the theft of indigenous lands by so-called settlers in the 1800s. He spoke out not recently or 50 years ago, but in the 1850s, when the white invasion of the West was actually happening. He was, in other words, a man who was way ahead of his time. And reading about him in Oregon Outcast made me think about activists today, who maybe are thought of as way out there or unrealistic, but are speaking truths we should be paying attention to now. The book's author, Jan Wright, has been our town's unofficial volunteer historian for a long time. And to research John Beeson's life, she uncovered everything she could find that he wrote or that was written about him at the time, including diaries and letters, as well as newspaper articles and speeches. Beeson was farming in Illinois before the Civil War, when he became active in the Underground Railroad, providing temporary shelter in his family's house for enslaved people escaping to freedom in Canada. Then in 1853, he decided to move his family to what is now Talent, where he bought a large piece of land from another white man. His move to Oregon is when his education about the treatment of indigenous peoples took a turn. All around him, the federal government was handing out land where Takelma, Shasta, and other tribes were already living. He saw that the government was compensating settlers engaged in killing off the existing residents, and that those indigenous people who survived were having their traditional areas for hunting and harvesting disrupted, and their salmon-bearing rivers and streams polluted by mining and grazing. Beeson also had to face the fact that the white man who sold him land had not compensated the indigenous people it had been taken from. At a church meeting, Beeson spoke out against settlers who were planning a massacre of local tribal members. But more than 100 white vigilantes went ahead with their plans, killing at least 28 men, women, and children in the early morning hours. After the murders, a major Oregon newspaper wrote, "It is true that we are in possession of the whole continent by force, but it is the force of good against evil, and God has sent us with the sword to exterminate a people who have nothing in common with humanity." In a protest letter published in a local newspaper, Beeson spoke about the fact that the white invaders had stolen occupied land, initiated violence, raped indigenous wives and daughters, and spread deadly infectious diseases. Months later, the local reverend, who was also the postmaster, opened a letter Beeson was trying to send to a San Francisco newspaper reporting on atrocities against indigenous people. The reverend and two local political leaders called a community meeting where that letter was read aloud, and where the community made it clear to Beeson that his life would be in jeopardy if he continued to live in Oregon. Within days, he had to say goodbye to his wife and teenage son and leave the area, at the same time that government forces were deporting tribal members to a reservation hundreds of miles away. Beeson spent most of the rest of his life in exile on the East Coast, campaigning for justice for indigenous tribes. He published a book called Plea for the Indians, in which he described the violence and injustices he had seen. He wrote that, "So long as our people deny to any class or color the common rights of mankind, neither peace nor prosperity can be made permanent, and our own rights will not be secure. Beeson also gave public lectures, including one attended by Abraham Lincoln. He published articles in dozens of magazines and church bulletins, often connecting the treatment of Indians to other issues, including abolition of slavery and women's rights. More than 170 years later, many of us look back at those who failed to listen to activists like John Beeson and wonder, what on earth were they thinking? How could they not see that what was being done to Indigenous people was wrong? But as I read Oregon Outcast, I thought about us today. Who are the voices we are not listening to now? Not only about continuing injustice for Indigenous people, but about our very future. What about those crazy people who say that we cannot address the huge problems facing our society as long as we live under capitalism, in which decisions are made based on profit for a few instead of the public good? Problems like climate change, or the cost and quality of housing or healthcare or education, or the huge gap in wealth between a few billionaires and the rest of us. What about those radicals and idealists who say that nations are outmoded in today's interconnected world, and that working people in America have more in common with our counterparts in other countries than we do with global financial speculators, corporate CEOs, and their political allies? Are people who say things like that the John Beesons of today? And will we fail to listen until it is too late? The book Oregon Outcast can't answer that, but by profiling a man ahead of his time, it can help us take a fresh look at our own.
Thank you, Matt Witt, and to other old moles who contributed to today's program: Patricia Kohlberg, Bill Resnick, John Nelson, Denise Morris, and to our guests, Bill Smaldone and Harold Johnson. A special thanks to the KABU staff for their great job in keeping the station going in trying circumstances. Please support the station in whatever way you can. This has been Norm Diamond. Tune in to the Old Mole next Monday. Meanwhile, stay safe and stay active.